In this episode of Movie Wallahs, we talk about Dune Part 2 and Problem Easter. It's time for Movie Wallahs. Hi, this is Joe.
Hi, it's Rashmi.
And Yusd as well.
Movie Wallahs is your weekly dose of film reviews, movie news and general banter in theatres, on DVD, online streaming or in the back of an airplane. If you love the movies, this show is for you.
You and you.
Okay.
All right. Here we are again. Recording again from Yazdi's house. Since we switched to video, we have always been at Yazdi's house.
Yeah.
This is true.
That's become our de facto studio, even though it isn't our studio. We have a studio in our house that we've yet to...
Well, this is not a bad studio.
No, but thank you, Yazdi, for hosting.
Yeah, we didn't move the pot, Yazdi.
Yes, I'm going to move the pot. Okay. Carry on.
The ceramic
last time we were drinking,
pot.
This time we are
People
not smoking.
People don't know what's in this pot.
For the audio listeners, which is the vast majority of you based on our YouTube number so far, it is a clay pot or a vase or a vase, depending on which version of English you speak. So, okay. Thank you again, Yazdi, for hosting. We've got quite a lot to talk about here. We've got Dune Part 2, and we're going to talk about Problem Easter. We've got time for some streaming picks as well. Also, just as a heads up, we hope to talk very soon, I guess, about the Oscars. So please listen out for that in our next podcast, which we'll hopefully, time permitting, chat about today. So, all right, why don't we then get into the main subject, meat of the podcast. Oh, no, let's talk about streaming picks, I guess.
Yes, let us do that.
Are you okay, Rashmi? You look very quiet. I'm like sitting here talking away. You're just staring at me like, what are you talking about?
No,
I was thinking,
there's a good reason. Because I was thinking you're talking very quietly.
Oh, well, that's because I can hear myself very loudly.
I know. So I was like, I don't know if I can't hear you or it's taking a few milliseconds to register. So I was thinking about it.
Okay, I'm doing more than my usual mumble. But yes, I can hear myself really loud in my headphones.
Oh.
And Yazdi, to his credit, did try and bring headphones today. But
I did.
But the technology was not compatible. Yazdi's only got advanced to Bluetooth USB headphones and... This is an old school recording deck.
Plus, I'm a robot. Okay.
All right.
Recommendation.
Then why don't we jump into our segment of I can't find anything to watch on video on demand.
Yes, you can go first.
Where we talk about the mess that is the streaming world right now with a million services and a million things to choose. And if you're like us, when we sit down to watch something, I spend 45 minutes trying to pick something.
I know, I get so mad.
And then I'm too tired to watch anything, and then I go to bed and the cycle repeats. So we are here to help you through the mess of everything. What you got in your streaming pick list, Yazdi?
So I'm going to cheat, and I'm going to make two recommendations, but I'm not just going to throw two movies. I want to recommend one movie which is in cinemas right now, which I don't think is going to be in cinemas too much longer, and I want everybody to go and watch it. That movie just kind of became a cloud of goodness and just kind of covered me completely while I was watching it. Mm. And it's about the two things I value most in life, which is food and cinema. So the movie I'm going to recommend is the French movie, A Taste of Things.
I know you've been championing this movie for the longest time, Yazdi.
It's a 2 hour and 15 minute movie, I think. And I think more than half the movie is just the gorgeous, most gorgeous, beautifully shot preparation of foods. It's based on a real story based on this cook who is responsible now, apparently, as being the originator of most of French food as we know it right now.
Really?
And he lived in the, he lived in the 1890s or something.
Okay.
And he would apparently have his friends over for these sumptuous 3, 4, 5 course meals, and they would just all sit together and eat and talk. And he had a main cook and an assistant. That's all he had. And everything was made with things which were available in the 1890s, and you watch it beautifully being prepared.
Ooh.
And on the face of it, it seems it's just about food being prepared, but it's actually very, very clever. There is other things going on. It talks about legacy. It talks about, you know, the, you know, what we miss and what we forget. And it's just so sumptuous. It's gorgeous. The movie is a little bit controversial because we may or may not have mentioned it in a previous podcast, but France, when they submitted their French movie for consideration for best foreign film, they picked this movie and they did not pick Anatomy of a Fall. And, you know, right, this movie has not even picked the best foreign film Oscar nomination, but Anatomy of a Fall, on the other hand, has picked 3 or 4.
Yeah.
So people are giving the, you know, the French people some grief that they should have picked Anatomy of a Fall. But I think they're both exceptional movies in different ways. I couldn't.
So this is not streaming.
This is in theaters right now. Although okay. I think it's.
So you definitely can't find it to watch on.
No.
Video on demand.
No, but soon it will, and it's got the lovely, yes, luminous Juliette Binoche. If that's what it takes, yes, you to get into the movie. So that's what I'm. My plea to everybody is: if you're looking for a great film to watch, do A Taste of Things. But for things to watch here, a lovely, gorgeous, beautiful movie that we all loved, which was released this year, has very quickly appeared on Hulu, and it's the movie, what is the movie? All of Us Strangers.
Oh, yes.
So All of Us Strangers.
Which is nominated.
It's not.
Oh, it was in the BAFTAs.
It was, yeah.
It was nominated for the BAFTAs.
It was nominated for BAFTAs. It won Andrew Scott Best Actor for it.
Yes.
It's an absolute travesty.
Fantastic.
It's a travesty.
Movie.
It hasn't been nominated for any Oscar, but it's an amazing film. It's a very odd film. It's a very unusually structured film, but I think everybody should watch it if you love cinema.
As reviewed by us in episode 527 of the podcast, so this will probably go out as episode 531. So just scroll a little back if you're new to Movie Wallers, and you'll hear all about All of Us Strangers.
Yep. So which we all loved.
Yes, All of Us. All of Us Strangers on Hulu.
Fantastic.
And what would be your pick?
So I think I'm going to do a little bit of a cheat as well.
Yay.
I was going to nominate one thing on Netflix, but I do want to highlight one of the best documentaries I've ever seen, which is playing on Amazon Prime for $2.99, unfortunately. But it will not be $2.99 wasted. It is the documentary called Iris, which is about this wonderful...
Oh,
and the reason,
yes,
I'm suggesting it is that this adorable, celebrated style maker, and she self-named herself the geriatric starlet, Iris Apfel, just died this week at age 102. And if you guys are interested in fashion or anything fashion-related, you will recognize her from her very iconic round black glasses.
She's been on the New York Times very often.
She's a wonderful person. I want to be Iris when I grow up. The documentary Iris is just a delightful documentary about her life and how she got into fashion and how much she's influenced the world around her. So Iris on Amazon Prime, and it's $2.99 to rent. But if you're looking for a free pick, then I'm going to suggest my new guilty pleasure. And it's really bad, but it's so good. It's so good, and I'm addicted.
Kardashians.
No, not the Kardashians. That's on Hulu, Yazdi.
Okay, sorry.
Which I know you've been streaming.
This might be a welcome to last week, given how many seasons of this show. I know what you're going to talk about here.
So. I am going to suggest the it's kind of it's a reality show called Love is Blind. And it's hosted by Nick and Vanessa Lachey. And I picked it up. I just thought this looks interesting. And I started watching episode 1 and I didn't realize it's already had 6 seasons. So I was compelled to watch season 6 and now I've gone back to season 1. And I just find it fascinating. So they bring together a group of men and a group of women and they keep them all separate and they have to date through these in these pods. And the idea is that you cannot see the person until you get engaged to them. So you have a week to get to know people, go on multiple dates, really make a connection, and then ultimately someone proposes to someone, then they meet, and then they get to spend time together. And then eventually, within 4 weeks, the idea is they walk down the aisle, and at that point, they can decide whether love is blind or not. So It's so, yeah, I can see you guys cringing. No, it's so bad, it's good.
Who signs up for this?
Needlessly dangerous.
It is, but you know what? I have cried, I have laughed, I smile when I watch the show, and I cannot stop watching it.
It's very popular.
It's a very interesting experiment to think that if you are committed to getting married, then are you willing to go through this exercise of meeting someone and really making a soul connection with someone? It's fascinating. Love is Blind on Netflix. 6 seasons.
And Rashmi, you have really been like...
I've been addicted.
Wait, addicted. Is it a different couple every episode or just two people and you keep...
No. It's like multiple couples and they're following multiple couples because at one stage you can make a connection with multiple people and then you have to pick one.
Okay, so there are brackets.
Okay. And actual marriages have resulted.
Actual
divorces have also resulted.
That's correct as well. There have been actual split ups, but there have. Okay. I was looking at the statistics, and some people have been married since 2018.
You know, it's funny.
Good, good.
It seems to me as if this is some sort of societal reaction to things like dating apps, right? Like Tinder dating apps are...
I mean, this could be Indian. This is an arranged marriage, so to speak.
Well, it isn't because the people get to choose themselves. But I'm thinking the experiment here is, you know, the dating apps, people see it like a still photo and they decide whether or not they would be interested in that person. It's purely based on a single still photo, how that person looks.
Yeah.
Oh, so you do have a photo.
No, you have nothing. No. You have nothing.
So this is what's going on in society, right?
Yeah.
People are hooking up on their cell phones by, you know, looking at a picture, swiping left, swiping right, but they don't necessarily get to know each other. So the very first thing. So here, the experiment is... they get to know each other by having these lengthy discussions. And they may have discussions for like weeks and months. And I mean, I wonder if there's a way of, they probably cheat, right? They can be like, what's your Instagram handle? Let me quickly.
What do you want?
They might be like, what's your Instagram handle?
They take their phones away. Oh, there's no social media.
For how long?
For the whole, like.
Okay, so let's assume they don't cheat. So this is like the opposite of like dating apps, right?
Yes.
Right. They build a connection.
Yes.
Yeah, it's an interesting experiment. Exactly. But who the hell signs themselves
people
up for that?
People who are serious about getting married.
Okay, well, that's Love is Blind.
Love is Blind on Netflix. Yes.
Okay.
And Iris on Amazon.
Okay, I'm going to talk about three things.
really?
You're being greedy. I'm going to get greedy.
Okay.
My actual first one is not really a pick. Okay. It's just something that... So Rashmi and I traveled this week. And when we travel, I watch terrestrial TV, which I never normally do at home. And so in flicking through channels...
Oh, my gosh. Really? You're going to talk about this?
I am going to talk about this. We talk about Blind Date. I'm going to talk about Naked and Afraid.
Which have we've never... Ever? None of us have either ever seen
this.
I've seen it.
This might be Welcome to Last Week. I've never seen this show before. This is like the most bizarre thing. I was flicking through...
It's been their number one show.
There's literally channel hopping, which I never do.
Yeah. On E, right? It's on E.
I don't know what...
I think this is on the Vice channel in the hotel. I don't know where it comes from. But what a bizarre thing. They put people in the middle of
it was weird.
Again.
In the jungle.
Again, it's needlessly dangerous.
Days, and they leave them there naked with like a person that they don't know of the opposite sex, I think. That was the premise of the one
I think it's always a male and a female.
Oh my goodness.
Well, and then it's like, go make your food.
I think it made me realize why we do Movie Wallah, so that I don't have to watch this drivel on TV. I mean, it was, I'll say this.
Yeah,
it
don't make out compelling. Like, I was going to say, you it make was, out like it was I've terrible.
Seen an, I've seen an episode while flying. On
the it was oddly compelling, but at the same time, I'm like,
why?
Why? Yes, why? Why would anyone ever do this?
And you were horrified, but like gleefully horrified.
Well, it was oddly... like I say, it was odd.
And I did say, I'm not watching, but you kept trying to pull me in.
Because this guy killed a snake and decided to chomp on a snake that he had roasted over a fire that he had built. I mean, this was just nonsense.
Needlessly dangerous. I'm going to keep repeating myself. Yeah.
So my second pick will be more relevant after you listen to our next review. But it's the original 1984 version of Dune on HBO Max. And I'm not going to talk about it now.
Okay.
I'll talk about it after we wrap up. Okay. But I think that's a worthwhile pick in the right context. And I say in the right context because the movie was horribly received at the time. David Fincher, who directed it. David Lynch, thank you. Backed himself away from the project. At one point, I think it was even released with a pseudonym as a director name because he really didn't want to have anything to do with it. But let's come back to why I'm thinking that might be a worthy watch after we talk about Dune Part 2.
Okay.
And then my real pick...
But there's a third one!
This is my actual pick.
Oh, my God.
I can't find anything to watch on VOD, right? This is a segment, so yeah. I'm finding something for you.
Yeah.
Which is the wonderful movie, I know I've recommended it before, The Gift. Yeah. It's the movie directed by Joel Edgerton.
Yes, great movie.
He should direct more.
2015. It's a mystery thriller.
Jason Bateman.
That's right. I forgot Jason Bateman was in this.
And Rebecca Hall.
Rebecca Yeldon is in this. No, that's a producer. Never mind. Yes, Rebecca Hall. I'm looking at the wrong Rebecca on the cast and crew. So yes. It's a wonderful thriller. Just do yourself
really
a favor.
Good movie.
It's 91 on Tomatometer, so it's not just me saying that this is good. This is genuinely good movie. I think we may have even covered it on a podcast many eons ago.
Many years ago.
The critics' consensus is it's wickedly smart and playfully subversive, challenging the audience's expectations while leaving them leaning on the edges of their seats, which I agree wholeheartedly
with. It's a great suspense movie, and it's not like, you know, terrifying or disgusting or any of it's just a good sturdy suspense thriller.
Yeah
it reminds me a little bit of Fatal Attraction in some ways.
Let's recap our actual picks, not our bonus picks. Yasti, your actual pick was
All of Us Strangers on Hulu.
Rashmi,
Love is Blind on Netflix.
And mine was The Gift, also on Netflix. All right, down to business.
Problemista.
Oh, okay. Are we doing that first?
Yeah, I think so, because then we can get that out of the way and then we can spend
Okay.
You,
all the time on Dune 2.
You completely tripped me up there, but
I
that's
know
fine.
You did. That's what I'm
rolling with it. I'm just going with it.
Rewrite
the podcast, why don't you?
Okay, I have the intro to this. And it's also a bit selfish because I'm dying to hear what it's like.
Yes.
I'm really sorry that Joe and I missed the screening of this because we were traveling for good reason. We went to see Madonna in Las Vegas, who was excellent.
Yeah.
If you get a chance to see her, please go see her.
Celebration tour. Expensive, but worthy.
And she comes on very late. She does. Anyway.
Yeah.
Also a problemista.
She's gotten sued. Yeah.
Okay. So Problemista is written, directed, and starring Julio Torres. And the description goes, Alejandro is an aspiring toy designer from El Salvador, struggling to bring his unusual ideas to life in New York. As time runs out on his work visa, a job assisting an erratic art world outcast becomes his only hope to stay in the country. And this mainly stars Julio Torres and Tilda Swinton, along with someone called RZA.
He's the musician.
Right.
There's, yeah.
Right. And it's also got Laith Knackley, who I remember from what movie was he in? He was in a really good movie. It will come to me. Greta Lee is also in here. Our lovely Greta Lee from Past Lives. Mm-hmm. And then a whole host of others. So Yazdi, is this one worth the hype? I'm really excited to see this one.
And it has been very well received.
Yeah, and I know you went to see this as part of they screened this as part of the Latino Film Festival.
Film Festival
in San Diego.
Which, by the way, opens next week. If you're in San Diego, the San Diego Latino Film Festival opens next week. They have an amazing selection of movies that they're showing, so we never miss an opportunity to champion our local film festivals. Please, if you're in the area, do yourself a favor and attend.
Okay. I'm sorry, Laith Lackey, the guy who is plays Khalil in the Problemista. I know his face from one of my favorite shows, Rami, which is also on Netflix, I believe.
Rami's on Hulu, I think.
Rami's on Hulu. Mm-hmm. Okay. Sneaky peek. Yazdi, how was Problemista?
So it's been 3 days since I watched Problemista, and every time I think about it, I get a big, giant smile on my face.
Aww.
And that says something, and I I've said this before, and I'll say it again. Sometimes all you need to know is a certain person is in a film, and you'll go watch that film. For me, all I need to know is the film is being distributed by A24 and I'll go watch that film. Yeah. This is another winner from A24. They picked it up, I think, at Sundance, and boy, did they do the right thing. This is what I wrote on my Letterboxd. I said, yes, we need VACO original voices just like this. Death to the pre-masticated studio drivel we are being constantly fed. And welcome to Julio Torres and his singular vision that brings thumping dramatic weight to the banal problems of our everyday. Not since being John Malkovich have I heard a voice this funny, deranged, committedly absurd, smart, and altogether its own. Problemista gives me hope for the future of cinema.
Goodness me, that's high praise.
High accolade.
This Julio Torres... he must be in his 20s. I don't know. Maybe he's in his 30s and looks very young. Yeah. I don't know. But he wrote, directed in it. He managed to get some pretty big name. Like Tilda Swinton has a huge role in this film. And he's so odd. His persona, like you almost laugh at him initially because he's like, nobody's like that in real life. But he sticks with that. And he takes this story through completely absurd turns. But you're smiling and laughing, and it brings it to a conclusion with so much ambition and so much creativity. This just makes me feel good about the state of American cinema. Let Julio Torres reign supreme.
Yeah, and it felt like it's going to be an immigration story mainly, but you've made it sound like it's more than that. Like, that seems to be the main premise, but...
So I don't even think it's as much... a key plot point is the fact that unless this kid, he's from El Salvador, unless he's able to find a job, he's going to be deported back to El Salvador.
Okay.
And a big, you know, there are several relationships in the movie, but the big relationship is between him and his mom is in El Salvador, and she really wants him to find a job.
Okay.
And through a matter of... you know, connections, he runs into this character played by Tilda Swinton, who oddly reminded me of my aunt who had come and stayed here a couple of weeks ago, in that, I'm not going to take any names, but in that...
Does she listen to the podcast?
Probably not, but Tilda Swinton, you know, at this point, how much more weird has Tilda Swinton left to get?
Right.
And yet she fully carves out this character of a person who...
And that can be annoying too, right? Having a character that's super annoying, you know, super quirky, just to fill a role can almost be kind of grinding. So she's not grinding?
She's not grinding because she's annoying. She kind of... is always looking to use people around her. She's selfish. She's all of these things, but ultimately she's a fully breathing, living character, and you believe her through her own kind of difficulties. And it's just, all I could think of was being John Malkovich. Remember where you were scratching your head like, you're going into somebody's head now. We're that absurd.
Yeah.
And the movie kind of goes with that. Every time he's imagining something in his head, you visually see the representation of that.
Okay.
So it's not like a, you know, $40 million movie. It looks like it was made from less than $1 million, but it goes with its kind of scrappy energy. It's just so entertaining. It's silly and funny.
Oh,
and,
I'm going to love
it. Lovely, yes.
Okay, score?
8 out of 10, only because... I mean, I think ordinarily if I saw this, this seems like a film festival movie to me. If I saw this, I would tell everyone. But number one, because it's such a fresh voice. It's so unique, right? By the time we see any movie these days in the theater, it seems like it's been through 100, you know, studio heads, and it's been through 100, what do you call them, where people sit together and...
Panels.
Panels and so forth. But this is such a singular vision. And this kid has kind of brought this movie into fruition through his own will, and there's something to be said for that. There's nobody I would not recommend to. If you like a little bit of goofy, silly charm, then Problemista is the movie for you.
It's R-rated. Goofy.
Is that for raunch or language?
It's language mostly.
Okay.
Yeah, it's mostly language. It's all language.
I pray at the church of goofy, silly charm.
Yeah, maybe you don't want to take your kid. There's one scene where something weird happens, but it's all part of the weirdness of the movie.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So watch out for Problemista.
Problemista, yeah. Rashmi and I will definitely get to that. And
definitely.
It's been well received. It's done well critically. Audience seem to like it too, which is always a good sign with a comedy.
Yes.
Because comedies can be limited in the scope, but
yeah.
It seems like it's got broad audience appeal too. So
and
it sounds wonderful.
And if it makes you change your mind, Emma Stone has produced the film. She's an executive producer. She probably saw it and loved it so much and she put her name on there.
That's great. Awesome.
Costumes, everything. It's a lot of fun.
All right.
Okay,
then
main
let's
event.
Jump into the main event. Yes, that's right, which is Dune Part 2.
So in 1965, Frank Herbert wrote what is now considered a seminal science fiction novel, which was called Dune. By most accounts, it does a lot of world building and it has a lot of gobbledygook. I must confess, I've tried to read it about 5 times and have not made it all the way to the end.
That's twice more than me, but 3 times I have started and failed to complete this novel.
But so influential was Dune that, you know, over the decades, you know, many different adaptations. There was, Joe, you mentioned earlier, there was the movie made by
David Lynch.
There was a miniseries with John Hurt. And then most recently, 2 years ago, it was resuscitated by Denis Villeneuve for Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers at that time, you know, were not willing to bankroll, you know, the whole movie, I mean, the whole series. And so they gave him just enough money to make the first one. And then if it did well, then they would do the second one. Well, the first one did very well. It was one of my favorite movies that year. And then now here is the second part of Dune. It's called Dune Part 2. Surprise. It's based on, obviously, Frank Herbert is the original writer of the book on which it's based. But the other writer credits are Denis Villeneuve and John Spates. And the movie has many of the actors from the first one and a few new ones. So Timothée Chalamet plays our reluctant hero, Paul Atreides. Chani is played by
Atreides.
Atreides. Zendaya plays Chani. Rebecca Ferguson plays Paul's mom, Jessica. Javier Bardem is here returning as well, as is Josh Brolin and Dave Bautista. And then, and Stellan Skarsgård also returns as the big, bad, evil villain in the movie. And then we have a whole bunch of new actors in part two, which includes Florence Pugh. It includes Christopher Walken. Christopher effing Walken is here. Lea Seydoux is here. And then Austin Butler, he of Elvis fame, plays Fade Rotha, also a bad guy in this movie. Charlotte Rampling from the original movie is here as well. So quite a stellar star cast. The second one in the series. What do you guys think of Dune 2? Part 2, sorry.
I am in love with this movie.
I'm actually very surprised by that.
I am in love with this movie. We watched it about a week ago, Yazdi, and since then I can't consume enough interviews with Timothée Chalamet and Zendaya, and they're kind of sending out, you know, Austin Butler and Florence Pugh, this kind of dynamic four who are doing tons and tons of press at the moment. Look, I think my viewing experience of this movie was enhanced by the fact that Joe insisted we watch Dune Part 1 before we watched Dune Part 2. And the other thing that enhanced it was not just getting a reminder of what Dune 1 was, but watching it with the subtitles on. Because, Joe, you'll say it better than I do. It has a terrific tapestry of characters and worlds, almost like Game of Thrones. And if you don't understand what those words mean, because they're not our everyday language, it's very unsatisfying in a sense to walk away from Dune 1. It's magnificent to watch, great cinematography, but if you don't get what all the little words are because we don't understand them, you do it.
Well, no, I was going to read the text message I sent to Yazdi, because I was saying to Yazdi, you know, I was trying to nudge him gently to kind of say, rewatch part one if you can.
With subtitles, because... read your text,
I wrote to him, and I know, Yazdi, you were very busy, so I wrote him a text saying, you don't necessarily need to rewatch it if you're confident that you know your Harkonnens from your Sardaukars and you understand the relevance of Lisa and Al-Ghaib in contrast to the greatness of Shai Halud. Of course, if you have any doubt about that, then the introduction of Irulan might Bene Gesserit your Kusat Hadarach, and you will be puzzled right from the outset. The point is, The Lexicon of Dune.
Yes.
And it's, yes, you mentioned world building. It is an entire universe, and it really, it's quite unforgiving.
Yes.
In terms of expecting you to keep up with its pace.
Right.
And
it's not talkie heavy, yeah, giving you an explanation. So
I'll
let
you wrap up and I'll kind of come back to that point.
No, I'm pretty wrapped up. So anyway, I love this movie. We can talk more about it. I love, 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 love this movie. That's not to say it doesn't have flaws and it's perfect. I'm just saying, as a visual experience of cinema going, this is the best.
Agree fully, Rashmi. I mean, I think, you know, the decision to rewatch part one also helped me a lot. Unlike you, I think, really enjoyed part one first time, but I felt like I was leaving a lot on the table, because as much as I enjoyed the spectacle of it all and the largeness of the story, I didn't appreciate some of the key plot elements. And by, almost to the extent I'm like, oh my goodness. In Dune part one, so statute of limitation on spoilers is like way past, but I didn't understand the manipulation that was going on by certain forces, yeah, the Bene Gesserits in the universe, which is actually a very important element of the story, especially as we go into part two when they build on those kind of things. So it really, to me, is super important. If you have any interest in Dune 2, it's probably because you've seen Dune 1 and enjoyed it. But unless you're intimately familiar with its universe, I think it is a very complex movie to appreciate. That said, absolutely, Rashmi. We watched it in a theater that had the biggest, loudest sound system.
With the speakers in the seats, yeah.
And, right from the get-go, it kind of, thumps its way into your consciousness. It's big, it's beautiful. I've seen the little jabs online about Lawrence of Arrakis, which is the Paul Atreides story has a lot of parallels with Lawrence of Arabia. It's set in the desert. There's a kind of a Middle Eastern type theme going on. So, I've seen that kind of joke, but the visual and the audio visual excellence of this movie is only bested by how it tells its story. It's grand on a scale that we don't often see in movies these days. So, props to Villeneuve for taking this project on. I'm really glad that he did what he did, which is break it into two movies.
Yeah.
There's something very interesting about the adaptation of this, as I've read around this topic, is that it leaves certain story elements mm-hmm. out of the picture.
Yeah.
And when I rewatched the 1984 Dune, they tried to cram more story elements into a shorter runtime. And as a result, I think got themselves into trouble with something that was very impenetrable to most audiences at the time. Here, by spreading it out and distilling out the core essences of a story, and they've made some certain choices. There's some big things left on the table in terms of the message behind the movie that if you've read the book or you're familiar with other adaptations, I'm rambling. This is great. Watch it, Yazdi. What did you think?
Yeah, and Yazdi, remind us, did you watch Dune Part 1? Okay, so that'll be a good comparison.
Yeah, I did not get a chance to watch Dune Part 1. But I love Dune Part 1 so much. I remember coming out of that movie and thinking, like, I just want to go to the cinema across from where I came out.
That's right,
and
watch, I remember, yeah.
Watch the second part. I was so eager for it. So here's what I'm going to say. It's February. And it's relatively early in the year, but I seriously doubt I'm going to see a more visually striking movie through the rest of the year. I just lost count of how many times my eyes just went into a state of giddy bliss.
Yeah.
Just watching what had been visually rendered on screen, just the imagination, just the visual flourish. I was like a child in a candy store. I was like, oh my God, how did they do it? And I wanted to imprint all of those images on my brain. But the movie, in spite of its long running time, it's so fast-paced. It's just
moving.
That I was almost like, remember this. I think this is how you deliver big budget blockbuster entertainment while also being rigorously inventive with the storytelling, with visual splendor and craft. There's a perception we have that, oh, if you're going to make a big you know, bulky blockbuster movie, then it'll just be for the masses. That it'll just be kind of things blowing up. And I think Villeneuve shows that you can take something this big and this complex and still be so ambitious with it and still deliver something with, you know, so much awe in it. And as far as I'm concerned, Villeneuve is close to like a prophet status in my mind when it comes to this kind of big vision cinema.
Yes.
There are a few things which don't work. And I think a lot of people complain that the movie is just big and pretty, but it doesn't have a heart. And I completely disagree.
I think.
And this is why I think, you know, it helps to know this, all these 10 different houses which are ruling and all of that. But Villeneuve has such a good... such a good way with storytelling that it's always obvious to you who the good guys are, who the bad guys are, who is manipulating whom, who is out to get what. I mean, you may not know their names, but for me, it seemed mythic and epic and very easy to understand.
Yeah, it kind of feels... I love the fact that... And I disagree with the comment that it has no heart. I think it has a lot of heart. Mm-hmm. And I think at its core, this romance that he manages to portray between the Chalamet character, between Paul and Charney, it becomes very small and all about them in this huge world and events that are happening in this galaxy, in a sense. And then the other thing is the cinematography is breathtaking. There's one scene that I... made sure I remembered, which is it's almost like a scene out of Gladiator. It's where the Austin Butler character basically goes in to fight. I won't say much more because I don't want to do spoilers, but it feels like that whole scene is shot in black and white, and it feels so sinister and so frightening in its scale that you can go from a moment of tenderness to a moment like that, which is so frightening and intimidating to watch. I was marveling at that tone change that's consistent with the story. Because we always talk about when something is tonally inconsistent, and if he wasn't the genius that he is, I think it would, you know, we would be sitting here saying, oh, it's tonally inconsistent, it goes from here to here. But how he manages those ups and downs and the ebbs and flows of the movie is just phenomenal to me. I just love this.
Yeah, it's very... different to part one as well. I think, you know, yes, it's two halves of the story, and obviously the story
arc. The pace is different.
But, part one was actually quite cerebral.
Yeah.
And quite, you know.
Like a boy's struggle to become, right?
Correct.
Kind of to carry the burden that is upon him in a way.
And it was, but it was building, I guess, the background for, and setting the table really for part two, which was... you know, a much more action-oriented movie, right? I think the first part was very gentle, and the word I'm kind of searching for is, I guess, you know, it was a very thoughtful movie. You had to think about all of the different dynamics at play, and I guess they had to do that because we didn't know the characters, we didn't know the houses, we didn't know the bigger picture, we didn't know how the Bene Gesserit directed their influence,
and they have a big part in this movie.
Story.
Yeah,
right. So you know, here now we've got all of those rules established, and it's like, okay, I've set up all my dominoes, and it's like tap, and they all start kind of interacting one by one, and it builds and it builds and it builds. I mean, it has that typical kind of blockbuster trait of having the big battle scene at the end, but it feels like it was earned. And the battle scenes, you know, I mean, yes, it's science fiction. You can kind of do anything you want with CGI, etc. But there's just such a kind of a visceral... And maybe it was the sound system and the Zimmer score here, but the texture and the punch and the grit and the explosions, it just had such a satisfying...
Yeah.
Big movie feel, which again, I feel like we don't get very much these days. It reminded me of being in a movie theater watching Return of the Jedi for the first time.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Right. The excitement.
Or Empire Strikes.
It was exciting.
Yeah. And I can't remember in recent years a movie having made me feel that same way in a science fiction setting.
I didn't want this to finish.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's one thing that you know, this, I won't just keep calling out Denis Villeneuve, the director, but his whole team who has you know, made this movie, is they have just such a good handling of scale. They know how to use scale to awe you, both you know, in terms of what you see visually, but also in terms of placing people. And then, like you said, at the heart of the movie is the relationship between Paul and Chani, and then it kind of just narrows down on the scale. So there's such a good handling of that. And I also like the fact, and this runs through both Dune 1 and Dune 2, is that major, major characters are dispensed off, like, in seconds. So nobody's really safe. And you know, my big complaint about all these superhero movies and a lot of Marvel movies is the last half an hour is just things exploding and then the hero and the villain fighting each other for, like, 25 minutes. It's like, come on, right? Whereas in Dune, all the battle scenes are done in like a minute and a half, right? So it's so not fussy. It's like, yes, this is the whole movie has led to this, but it doesn't need to be 20 minutes of them fighting with each other. It can be done like in a minute and be effective and kind of, you know, get on with it. So I really appreciated that. And I love that, as complicated as it is, it's bringing in new characters and they're still, you know, they're understandable. You know, yeah, where they stand in the whole story.
I mean, I was just thinking the level of imagination that's been applied to this in terms of the production design, the costume, just adds such a rich texture and such a believable world. I actually felt like I'd not gone on vacation is a weird thing to say, but yeah, I literally
lost
had been
in that world,
yeah, transported and lost in this world.
Yeah, I almost went to see the same screening that Yazdi attended.
Oh, you wanted to go again?
I was,
yeah,
like, what are we doing tonight? You know, like in my head, I was just like, ugh, I just want to go and experience that again. I think, you know, I may do. Again, I can't emphasize how important it is to see this in the highest quality theater that you have access to. And if that's an IMAX theater or one of these, you know, RPX, I think they call them, like, invest the money. It's absolutely worthwhile. From the very, just before the movie opens, right, the lights go down and there's just like, there's a voice that,
yes,
kind of booms out throughout the, it immediately got my attention. The sound design is something else. And, you know, Zimmer is doing his normal kind of, you know, loud clattering soundtrack, but the original, the part one soundtrack, is something that Zimmer did actually get carried away with. If you have a streaming service, there's multiple albums of the Dune soundtrack. So there's the actual one from the movie, but then there's kind of an extended version where a lot of the flavors and themes that he explored creatively, he's just put out there as a second album. And he's having more fun here. Again, it amazes me. Zimmer is probably my favorite composer of modern times, and just the inventiveness and the what he brings to this movie. You know, it's
like a language. The music is its own language and its own character.
Expressing that much more succinctly than I was.
Yeah, it, like, there's this hum and these noises and clanks, and it's fantastic.
It feels otherworldly.
Yeah,
which, you know, but it also has that kind of familiar Middle Eastern
yes,
flavor to it, and that, you know, and that's by design, right? This world has been created with some parallels to our world and our story. You know, Frank Herbert has been open about the influences used to craft his Dune world, and a lot of that is from the Eastern cultures. So yeah, wonderful stuff.
I mean, for all its gobbledygook, there's a reason why, you know, Dune as a story has endured, right? More than 50 years since it was first written, because it touches on, I mean, this movie is really ripe for dissection politically, spiritually, from a perspective of, you know, who gets access and who does not. All of these themes are there. I mean, one theme which was beautifully rendered, I think, in the first part by Villeneuve was, you know, the concept of the reluctant hero. What if everybody expects you to become the hero and you don't want to, right? So some are great, some are born great, and, you know, some are made great and some have greatness thrust upon them. Here is a case of, you know, Paul doesn't want any of this. He's forced into it. And that concept is, again, so beautifully reiterated in the second one. But it also talks about very, very relevant terms right now of what is the price of blind faith, right? What, like, if somebody is telling you that a Messiah is going to come, how much of that is self-fulfilling when something happens? So it talks about that. It talks about, look at the story, right? It's set on a desert which has the spice, and the spice is what drives energy around the entire world. And it's not too different from, you know, our current world, where the, you know, the Middle Eastern countries have oil. And so the whole thing about the Freemans wanting to, you know, reclaim the spice and reclaim their profit is speaking to, you know, everybody imperialistic wanting this oil for their... So there's so many parallels. The one thing I heard, and I hadn't heard this before, and it got me thinking, the one negative thing I heard... And Villeneuve said that he has acknowledged this, and there's no way getting around this aspect of the story. So this was brought up at the NPR Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast on the movie where they reviewed it. And they said one big problem with this movie is it really furthers the white savior trope, right? So this group of people are unable to fight back on their own until Paul arrives. And Paul with Chani starts kind of building their strength, and he kind of leads this group. They believe he's the Messiah. And so it kind of furthers this pale-skinned person who comes and helps the dark-skinned people kind of prevail. And I can see it, but that's okay with me. Okay, fine. I can recognize that that's a trope that probably doesn't need to be furthered. But again, this is based on a book written more than 50 years ago, and I'm fine with it.
Yeah. And I think that's just a very woke reaction to the movie's theme, because I didn't really think of the Fremen as dark-skinned people.
No, I didn't either. But I did think of them as Middle Eastern, though.
We did think of them as Eastern. They're
white.
They're white, brown, and black. Like, I didn't really see that as... You know, yes, I could see why somebody might say, oh, you know, the sand people. But I think that, to me, is just somebody who's gotten a little too carried away with that.
But outside of
the white savior narrative. Because that's not what this movie was trying to do at all.
No, but forget their skin color. It is about somebody from another planet coming and saving this oppressed people.
Of course.
So that's not
a white savior thing. That's just a
Jesus thing. That's totally a Jesus thing. So it is, of course it is. It is a white... So there are all these religious and political elements, which is fine. I mean, I'm not saying boo on the movie. I think, you know, it's a brilliant of a movie, but I acknowledge there are these components in the movie.
Yeah, disagree. So.
I did like all the girl power with the Bene Gesserit, though. I thought that was a really interesting part of the movie, that there is this really powerful group of women that basically run the universe. That was interesting.
Or busybodies. They feel to me they struck me as like the old women that would gossip over the fence and say, right, we should marry this one to this one, and they'll make a lovely couple.
Sure.
No, I'm just joking. But yeah, no, I mean, for all this ambition, I think the one thing that this movie does that was different in the adaptation from 1984 is, and this is kind of where, you know, the messianic type thing, in the 1984 David Lynch version, and I don't know if this is truer to the source material or not, because I haven't read the darn book. It's too impenetrable.
Maybe we should commit to all three of us reading it.
No, I've tried.
Oh, have you? I've never even tried.
There's actually a very good audible audio version of it, which I've got the deepest into of any attempt to read the book. But it's very hard to read. But the point is, in the 1984 version, it's very much more a messianic rise that he has, whereas here Paul is kind of resisting that idea
the whole time. Yeah,
like, you know, and I don't want to get too much into the spoiler territory of the movie, but there's definitely a walk back from the kind of the deity type thing and the powers. In 1984 version, the Paul character actually develops a lot of supernatural type abilities and power as he goes along his journey. Here, that's dialed back. I think there is suggestion that there will be a third movie, Dune Messiah, which was the follow-on book, As alluded to by the ending, by the way that this movie ends. And I think that will probably explore a lot more of those themes. But I really appreciated them kind of dialing back that that kind of supernatural thing. What we have here is a story of the reluctant leader, right?
Yeah.
The person who is positioned by history, by external forces. By his own mother to be this figure that allows, that then kind of undertakes on, you know, global warfare and politics, you know. That's really, really well done here.
Actually, that's a part which, again, this, you know, the creators of this version have done a really good job, is he doesn't have any supernatural powers, but through the first movie and the second movie, he has a lot of visions, right? He has a lot of visions. And I think the movie is such a good commentary on, if you're seeing visions, and I'm not just saying visions from a mental health perspective, but if you have a premonition or a vision, how do you deal with that? Do you just say, no, I'm going to ignore all of that and just live my life? Or are you going to allow those visions to drive you? So for me, that was a very, very fascinating part. And Paul is struggling with that through the whole movie. So that's very good. I just want to take a minute to talk about how wonderful the casting is in this movie.
Yes.
Like, Rebecca Ferguson had a lot to do in the first movie, but here she is. She undergoes a transformation, and she's
quite the action hero that we saw in Mission Impossible. I mean, she's fantastic.
She sticks the landing.
Yeah.
I think this movie is as much Zendaya's as it is
Totally.
To the point that, again, I won't go into spoiler territory, but there is a late stage development, maybe in the last 10 minutes of the movie, where she hurts, and that hurt felt very real to me. You know, and it's because, again, Zendaya is very, very good. She's a great actor. We know that from, you know, other things she's done. But here, you know, she becomes the heart of the movie, and she's the person who refuses to believe prophecy. She refuses to believe that there is a Messiah. She is the new generation, if you will, who is like, no, none of this. I won't become a prisoner to this. And her character is so well developed, even as the movie's going on.
All of them are. I think, I mean, even though this is the first time we're seeing the Austin Butler, I can't even pronounce his name.
Phaedra Rotha.
This is the first time we're seeing his character, the first time we're seeing Florence Pugh's character. They're all so well-formed. You know who these people are when we see them in such a short time. You know, there isn't much time for character building for those newer characters, but we know who they are.
Well, there's quite a few necks get cut in the presence of Austin Butler. I was like,
the what?
There's quite a few necks got slashed. Like, throats got cut.
A lot of necks were being slashed.
That was really like, I was like,
yeah, and that was kind of like some cannibalism, vampirism. Very well.
But there was something so deliciously
evil and
sinister.
Sinister and unstabilizing. I was like, I don't
almost
want to be close.
Almost Nazi-esque. And if you think about the Harkonnen, I feel like they were almost portraying.
The weakest link in the cast for me was Christopher Walken.
Me too.
Normally
I agree.
I'm an absolute, like, he's the coolest guy on the planet.
But I think that's for a reason. He doesn't have a backbone. And I think that's what they're trying to show you.
Sure. But it just felt like that was maybe the wrong casting decision then, to put someone like him in there, because I felt the weakness of the character, and he didn't feel like he brought his A game compared to everyone else here, who absolutely knocked it out of the park and then some.
He was interviewed, Christopher Walken was interviewed for this movie, and he said that Villeneuve begged him to take that role. And he said, why me? Like, I'm the last person who should be playing the role. And he said, I don't know how to be royal. I don't know how to be king-like. And apparently Villeneuve said,
that's what you want.
You don't have to be king-like.
Correct.
You become king-like by virtue of how everybody else around you behaves in your presence. So he says, you won't have to do much. I'm hoping, I haven't read the books. I'm hoping that he'll have bigger role in part three, if there is a part three. So, yeah, I mean, he doesn't have much screen time. Also, a shout out to Javier Bardem, who brings so much humor into this unexpectedly. Yes. The first movie had no humor, I think. And this one, he just brings so much humor, very effortlessly. Yeah.
Yeah, the heart.
The heart as well. And one more thing about Austin Butler. He could have easily, you know, been on, you know, taken the path of being in romantic comedies or whatever, but he's just doing very, very interesting work.
Yes.
Right? There's no reason he needs to take on the role of this super sleazy, bad, evil guy. And yeah. I think he's, you know, I'm happy with his choices.
This was the character played by Sting in 1984.
Ah, okay.
Okay.
All right. I think we've worn out our welcome with this one now, I think.
Yes.
All right. You go first, Rashmi.
9 out of 10. I love this movie. Yeah. And again, that's not saying it's the best movie in the world. It's just, it's so bombastically entertaining and a visual feast.
Yes. For me, it's a qualified 9 out of 10 because I don't know that this movie will have universal appeal. I've spoken to people who don't like part one. And, I think that there's... And like I say, it's an easy 9 out of 10, but this movie just, it requires homework. It did for me.
Especially if you didn't love part one.
It did for me. I mean, part one I admired, but I couldn't bring myself to love it because I didn't understand it. When we rewatched it, that's when all the pieces kind of clicked into place. And yeah. I was like, okay, now I get it. Oh, these are the Harkonnens. Oh, what are you talking about? Sardaukars. Like, the language was almost impenetrable. So all I'm saying is, for it to have a broader appeal, I think just takes a little bit of effort. And if you make that little bit of effort, at least for me, it was, of the three of us, I'm the one that kind of struggles with the abstract. So I have to have things laid out for me so that I can understand them. And that's what this needed. And with that little bit of effort, it was just boom. If I'd gone in to see this without rewatching part one, I would have had a very different experience.
I mean, I did see it without watching.
Yeah, what's your score? Yeah.
And
what's your score, Joe?
Nine. A qualified nine.
A qualified nine.
Again, I'm going to repeat what I said at the outset. Like, I'm really struggling how any other movie released this year is going to be more visually more impressive than this one. I think if you're a lover of cinema, just go to see what's rendered on the screen. The grandness, the scope, the cleverness.
The detail,
the storyboarding, all of that. And, Villeneuve has taken something which has befuddled decades of filmmakers
Absolutely.
And he has kind of righted a big problem with the original source, which is gobbledygook. And, so sturdy is the storytelling, both visually and emotionally. Mm-hmm. That it completely overcomes the excessive mythos and labyrinthine world building of the story. And, we've been big fans of Denis Villeneuve. He did Arrival and he did
Place Beyond the Pines.
He did what was that? The border one. The cockroach, what it means in cockroach. Anyway, it'll come to me.
The what? The cockroach?
Yeah. It's with Emily Blunt. Anyway, he's made Enemy with Jake Gyllenhaal.
Blade Runner, he did. Prisoners, did.
Yeah, Sicario.
Sicario, that's the one.
Cockroach.
Sicario, yeah. But anyway.
What are you talking
about?
But,
he's a tremendous filmmaker, but I think he's reached the pinnacle of all his skills with the telling of a story so epic. And, after the first one made a ton of money, Warner has given him so much more to play with, and he has not wasted any of it, and he comes out right on top.
Yeah.
9 out of 10 easily for me. I had at any minute in during watching it, I was completely enthralled. I'm like, what kind of bliss is this?
Yeah. I guess the question I have for you is we did a press only screening, so it was just like a handful of us in a cinema. You did an audience screening. How was the Were there gasps in the audience?
There were gasps. People were clapping when it ended. Everybody clapped, even though it kind of ends on a somber note.
Yeah.
People clapped. The people had brought kids along. Everybody was kind of enraptured.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
And I'm just very grateful to Denis Villeneuve and the studio for not releasing this in the same year as Oppenheimer, because it would have robbed Christopher Nolan of his very likely best director.
Yeah, I think you're right.
This is an astonishing directorial accomplishment. I agree with everything you said there, Yasti.
Mind you, it was going to be released last year.
I know.
And because of COVID, it got delayed.
And I'm very glad about that because I want Nolan to get his Oscar.
When I came out of the movie, this is what I told,
the rep.
Not the rep, the person who was sitting next to me, one of our fellow reviewers. I said, I'm almost upset that this is being released in February, now March, because I don't want the buzz of this movie to wear off by the time November comes along. This should be a movie which should be under contention for the best of the year. But I'm hoping that the goodwill and, you know, once people watch it, that it'll carry through the end of the year. But it's marvelous filmmaking.
I don't know what decision is to release at this time of year. This would be a huge summer blockbuster.
I think they probably got tired of keeping it.
Yeah. Wow.
It's like the best kept secret in a sense, right? You can't hang on to it for too long.
And then just before we kind of wrap up, so bringing us back to the 1984 Dune.
Yes.
The reason I recommended that as a streaming pick, having watched this, is it's got a lot of the elements here. There's a lot of similarities. There are actually a lot more similarities than differences, and I was surprised by that. You know, right down to specific lines of dialogue, which presumably are taken straight from the source material, the book. Now, that movie was criticized kind of extensively, and it's got a very interesting visual style, David Lynch. So, you know, it's very stylish. It's you know, a little, you know, the costumes and the way that the lines are delivered are very 1980s. So it's aged, but it added a couple of beautiful little bits of color to the world that Villeneuve deliberately dialed back. And yes, it's a slightly different take on the story. Like I said, in the Villeneuve version, I think there is this reluctance by Paul to be this leader, whereas that didn't come across so much in the 1984. And it also completely vindicates the decision to put this story into two movies, because as one, it hops from scene to scene. But, you know, as a kind of nugget, a 2-hour, 15-minute nugget-sized version of the Dune story, it's actually kind of a fun thing to watch, because you see the different houses. I think there are connections that I wouldn't have made watching that one without Villeneuve's version.
Oh, really? Okay.
That make perfect sense. So, you know, it shows just how Villeneuve and his team have delivered something that's just so much more effective as a story, but it's still worth watching.
And there's a great line in the movie, which is that prophets only get stronger after they die. So be careful of bringing down your political enemy, because it may have exactly the opposite reaction. And it's so, it just rings so true, like even now. So yeah,
I want to be careful with that one. Goodness me. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. We've rambled on for an hour somehow. Let's
really
wrap up today's podcast with a thank you for watching and listening. We are going to be putting these things out on YouTube for a while, so please do check our YouTube subscription. You can find us at youtube.com/moviewallers, simple as that. And I've added all of the recent ones to kind of a podcast feed, so you can subscribe if you like. Again, let's continue this experiment for a while, and you know, please tell your friends. All right, yes, you were going to say something.
There are 25 subscribers right now on YouTube, Movie Wallahs. It would be good if there were 250. I'll just.
Well, but you
that.
Haven't even made it public yet, right? So these are friends of the podcast
you're
so
right.
far.
No, I've put the links out there. If anyone knows how to do social media marketing on YouTube, please let me know, because I would love for this to fall into people's algorithms. Dune will be the first kind of the big movie that we talk about here, so I'm hopeful that will get some traction as well. All right. Let us know what you think of the YouTube format too. mail@moviewallahs.com, or feel free to comment underneath the YouTube video itself. We'd love to hear that. And yes, I think I made you an admin, Rashmi. I think I haven't made you an admin yet, but you will be very soon. All right. End of the podcast. Too many movies, too little time. A goodbye from me.
And me.
And me as well.